Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Vladislav Lilic, a doctoral candidate in modern European history at Vanderbilt University. In today's episode, I am joined by Adam Gerachiu, the Neubauer Family Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. We will be discussing her fascinating first book, World Making After Empire, The Rise and Fall of Self-Determination, published by Princeton University Press in 2019. The work has received immense praise from academics and non-specialists alike, winning a plethora of awards, including the Franz Fanon Prize, the W.E.B. Du Bois Distinguished Book Award, and the J. David Greenstone Book Prize. It re-narrates the 20th century history of decolonization. Gerachiu shows that African, African-American, and Caribbean anti-colonial nationalists were not solely nation builders. Responding to the experience of racialized sovereign inequality, dramatized in the book by interwar Ethiopia and Liberia, Black Atlantic thinkers and politicians challenged international racial hierarchy and articulated alternative visions of world-making between the 1930s and the 1970s. Seeking to create an egalitarian post-imperial world, they attempted to transcend legal, political, and economic domination. They sought to secure a right to self-determination within the newly founded United Nations, constitute regional federations in Africa and the Caribbean, and create the new international economic order. World Making After Empire traces the richness and ambition of post-war attempts to reimagine the international order, uncovering a multitude of political projects that decolonization entailed. Dr. Gerachiu, welcome to New Books in History, and thank you for taking the time to talk to me about your work.
Thanks so much for having me.
As is customary on our channel, I will start us off by asking about the genesis of World Making After Empire. How have your intellectual trajectories led you to the writing of the book?
Sure, yeah. So this book started as my dissertation. I was a joint PhD candidate in political science and African American studies at Yale University. And I think you can see how it's informed both by an interest in Black internationalism and Pan-Africanism coming out of broadly African-American studies and Africana studies and by political theory. So I think it was really intersecting, a few intersecting debates, political and theoretical, that shaped the book. One is it was written, of course, in the post 9/11 period, a period where I saw a resurgent American imperialism, and raised a whole set of questions about the transformation of international order in the wake of America's preemptive wars in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, and then later the intervention in Libya. And you know, there in political theory, leading up to this period, there had been this kind of enthusiasm for what was called a post-Westphalian world order, a world order that would break with kind of the nation-state form, that would maybe rethink and reimagine non-intervention sovereign equality, with the hope of generating a more humane international order that protected the rights of individuals. And in some ways, there was this erosion of sovereign equality of non-intervention, but it seemed like what it yielded actually was imperial power rather than the protection of individual rights. So one ambition of the book is to return to a period when sovereign equality especially emerged as a central principle, and to trace the ways in which ideas of international equality were debated and institutionalized during the age of decolonization. Relatedly, I'm really interested in questions of Black internationalism and Pan-Africanism. So I was interested in how earlier formations of Black internationalism translated or didn't translate into the age of decolonization. And, I think there's been a lot of work on the rich versions of anti-colonial internationalism in the interwar period. And that's a period in which these visions aren't tied to the state yet. So I both try and think about how these figures extend those preoccupations, but they do so in the context in which the state is the kind of institutional basis of the international order. And so theirs is really an internationalism of the nation state, of the state. So these are the two kinds of things the book brings together. And it again, emerging out of the connections between political theory and African-American studies.
Yeah. You set out by offering a new political theory of decolonization. So the book argues that we have missed the full extent of anti-colonial nationalism's radical departure from the world of European empires. So how can your analysis of Azikiwe, Du Bois, Krumah, Padmore, Williams, the so-called university generation of the 1930s, help us rethink empire and international order as analytical categories?
Great. Yeah. So one intervention that I think this set of actors makes, and it really their analysis does begin in the 1930s, is to imagine the world, imagine the imperial world, not only as structured by a set of bilateral relationships between a metropole and its colonies, but to conceive of empire as a structure of unequal integration and racialized hierarchy. They do this in two kinds of ways. One, a number of these figures, Padmore especially, Du Bois to some extent, are right about the experience of the three black sovereign states at this time, Haiti, Liberia, and Ethiopia. And these become a model for them about the ways in which imperial encroachment, imperial domination persists, even when there's formal independence. The second way they do this, again, here, Eric Williams would be important, Du Bois is important, C.L.R. James is important, is tell a longer story about the significance of the transatlantic slave trade and slavery to the making of the modern world. So from its very foundations on this view, the world was both integrated by experience, by the kind of histories of European imperial expansion, but integrated in uneven and unequal ways, and thereby generating these forms of inequality and hierarchy that persisted into the 20th century. So it's this kind of international and global framing of the problem of what empire is that then generates this thinking about world anti-colonial world making.
Fascinating. And new historical scholarship has revealed the imperial origins of the League of Nations and the entire interwar global political architecture, as it were. How do you mobilize this historical experience of Ethiopia and Liberia's burdened membership in the League to examine the nature of racialized unequal integration into the post-1918 world order?
Yeah, great. There's been historical work on the same topics, right? Rethinking the imperial foundations of international law and beginning to do the work of reimagining decolonization. So what I do in this chapter is, I think there's been especially a lot of interest on the mandate system when thinking about the internationalization of empire, the ways in which some form of international administration of colonies was introduced, and both the ways that that entrenched forms of empire, right, and made this kind of empire subject to international opinion and international oversight in really productive ways. And here I'm thinking especially of the central work of Susan Peterson in her book, The Guardians. So what I try to do in this chapter is focus less on the mandate system and highlight these two African states, Liberia, which is a founding member of the League, and Ethiopia, which joins in 1923. Both of them, there would be many questions about whether Ethiopia should be admitted at all, but ultimately it's admitted. But for both states, there's a worry that that ongoing practices of slavery within the territories of these two countries means that, you know, they haven't fulfilled the requirements for membership. But, you know, whereas we think of, say, something like the 19th century standard of civilization as a kind of exclusionary binary or a boundary, what we get here is that they are incorporated as members of the League, but membership is taken to be a mechanism for supporting slash disciplining them to become proper members, proper states, and proper members of the League of Nations. So what I argue is that this generates a form of burdened membership. And what I mean by burdened membership is that obligations, international obligations, are more onerous than the rights that membership secures, and that those rights are also conditional on having fulfilled or realized these obligations. I also say this was a racialized form of membership. And what I mean by that is not just that these were African states and Black states, but that in this 10-year, almost a little over 10-year period, this constant preoccupation with whether or not Ethiopia and Liberia have met their obligations, this constant answer that they haven't or they're incapable of meeting their obligations, increasingly generates a racialized form of sovereignty, a sense that actually there's a fundamental reason that these states are incapable of realizing the kind of ideal form of the state and of being full members of the League of Nations.
And the conventional accounts of the rise of post-war anti-colonialism have focused on the nation and state-making processes. And you actually demonstrate that alternatives to the nation-state persisted at the height of decolonization in the post-war era. So how does your study of largely forgotten projects of regional federation in the West Indies and Africa expand our understanding of self-determination as a concept?
Yeah, here too, I should say that I'm, participating in a conversation with historians who've worked primarily on the Francophone context, like Fred Cooper, and Gary Wilder, who similarly are interested in this ways in which federation, and in that case, French federation, the idea that one could transcend the imperial structure and reimagine the relationship between France and its colonies, was a way of securing a meaningful vision of self-rule. So I look at Anglophone thinkers in both the African and Caribbean context who are making the same kind of critique. They're arguing that given the ways in which the international order is structured by deep forms of inequality and hierarchy, especially around the question of economic dependencies, that, you know, these small states on their own would be constantly subject to dependence, hierarchy, and intervention. The people I'm thinking with are Eric Williams and Kwame Nkrumah. Both of them argue that forms of regional federation would be a way of kind of minimizing or exiting these international structures of domination. And so I look at this as an example of trying to use regional institutions as the basis of realizing national independence. And I think what's really important about this is it shows it shows a certain flexibility about thinking about sovereignty, right? I think it's very striking, for instance, that Ghana's Republican Constitution of 1960 includes a clause that sovereignty can be delegated in whole or in part to a regional federation. And it alerts us to the ways in which I think that kind of flexibility, some flexibility about the thinking of sovereignty at the regional level, alerts us to the ways in which this critique of kind of persistence forms of hierarchy and dependence generated or propelled anti-colonial nationalists to pursue these regionalist and internationalist ambitions. So I think what's really interesting here is that this is a form of internationalism that's not anti or non-national, right? It's precisely the attempt to think through what national independence requires in an unequal world that generates the search for regional institutions.
Mm-hmm. So this interplay between nationalism and internationalism or cosmopolitanism even reminds me of that liberal Mazzinian phase or stage of the development of European nationalism in the 1860s. How does your approach help us reframe nationalism as a historical force?
Yeah, great question. Well, I think generally, you know, like others who've written in this vein, I'm thinking of Manu Goswami, Glenda Sluga, and others, a number of historians have made this point that we have to study nationalism in historical context, in historical specificity, to think about the ways, what combinations, what possibilities it generated. And that it's not to say that nationalism necessarily entails cosmopolitanism or internationalist ambitions, yes. But I think any nationalist project has to imagine itself in a world, you know, and it has to have some concept, some vision of what it's in, what world or context it's inaugurating its political project, and it has to figure out what its relationship to that world is going to be. And so in this case, this primary emphasis on, you know, as I was saying, these relations of dependence and hierarchy generates versions of regionalism or internationalism they take several moments, right? At certain moments, it's an attempt to set up barriers, right? So one version of that in the right to self-determination is around non-intervention as the central element of the right to self-determination, right? A second version, as we've talked about in the regionalism version, is to create new forms of regionalist links, internationalist in that version, as a way of mitigating some of the consequences of these larger hierarchies. And a third version in the new international economic order takes the form of trying to take the world as one unequal unit and imagine forms of redistribution within that one world. So even within this version of kind of the combination of nationalism and internationalism, I think we see three different strategies for how this relationship is, imagined and constituted. I think there's another part that's less present in the book, but I think is important, is just how, you know, the circulation of ideas, the circulation of people becomes a really important vector for how these nationalists imagine the projects that they're engaged in. So one specific example, again, on the regional federations piece is the reading of the American Federalists from the 18th yes. century and the ways in which that shapes the imagination of federation and regionalism.
It's incredible. In my previous research, I've looked at a number of Balkan intellectuals from the 1870s who had also been inspired by American federalism in their own thinking of or about a post-imperial order in the Balkans. And some of our listeners might be keen to learn more about the idea of Pan-Africanism. Could you perhaps walk us through the details of this vision and how it rose and fell in both Africa and the Caribbean in the 1960s?
Yeah, great. I think that's a great question. I mean, different versions of it rose and fell at different moments, but we can just take the question of the federations for a second. I think that, one way I try to, one way I kind of explain this failure, I think, is by saying for Nkrumah and Williams, in order for federation to do this work of undoing and mitigating against these relations of hierarchy, it had to be a highly centralized federation. It had to be a central federal government capable of organizing robust visions of taxation, of development, right? It's a planning state. The federation had to be a planning state, and as I tried to show, there was a lot of anxiety, right, that this was going to just create another form of hierarchy, right? That member states would now be subject to the authority and power of a regional hegemon or a regional government that would kind of replay these dynamics of domination, possibly. You know, in retrospect, it's been a couple of years now since the book has come out. I've been thinking about other possibilities that explain the failure of these federations. So one is that in all of these cases, I mean, even in the case of the Caribbean, which experiments with federation before the island states actually gain independence. In each of these cases, there had been the devolution of power to the territorial units had already happened. So for instance, universal suffrage is introduced in Jamaica in 1944. National parties are formed. They're competing and organizing themselves around the territory of a territorially organized polity called Jamaica, right? And so by the time the debates about federation really get formed and kick off and that would be in like 1958, there's already a set of attachments and connections to politics organized at this territorial unit. The same is true in the African context. So, I mean, in that case, it's even more true because independence happens first and then federation is debated. But I think what this sequence means is that the possibility of building the popular base of federation, right, organizing and mobilizing around a federally organized territorial unit, never fully occurs, right? Instead, what happens is both projects end up becoming more kind of interstate negotiations rather than forms of politics that are federal all the way down. I can speak about, I'm happy to take up also the question of more generally the fall of self-determination now, or we can leave it for later.
It's on my list.
Okay, good. Right.
Post-colonial world-making projects, I mean, were not historically static, and you showed that quite forcefully. You showed that the early failures of federalization and troubled independence that followed spurred a new round of ambitious recasting of the idea of sovereign equality. How did the likes of Michael Manley and Julius Nyerere seek to articulate a new political economy of self-determination? So that's the second stage of world-making. How did the idea of a new international economic order fare in the 1970s?
Great. So yes. Both of these federations projects we've just been talking about basically come to an end in the early 1960s. The West Indian Federation and comes to an end in 1962 when Trinidad and Jamaica gain independence. In the African context, the Organization of African Unity comes into being in 1963, and that's really a treaty organization. So it kind of, it suppresses or displaces the possibility of a more radical version of political integration. This moment also coincides with a growing economic concern, described as the declining terms of trade. Many of these states are primary goods producers. The price of their goods are declining dramatically on the international markets. And it means that their capacity to engage in the developmental visions and ambitions they have, which depend on foreign currency, et cetera, are being, you know, are undermined, right? Or their capacity to buy the goods that they would need for those projects is being undermined and diminished. So what makes the new international economic order distinctive from the regional federations is this view that it takes for granted that we do live in one integrated world, but it's an unequal world. But instead of trying to delink or remove oneself a little bit from that world, it says let's take on the problem of inequality at the international level. And both Nyerere and Manley do this in part by recasting that inequality as an international division of labor, by likening the relationship between post-colonial state to and you know, global north as a relationship between worker and capital, or sometimes between rural and urban sectors. What this analogy to the domestic division of labor enables is a way of thinking about how the mechanisms of distribution, inaugurated with the welfare state in the domestic space, might be internationalized and globalized. So here there is two versions of the radicalization of sovereign equality. One, there is a claim that each state should be able to participate in the decision in economic decision making, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That the UN General Assembly should be thought of as a kind of parliament of the world, and that it should play a important role in setting the terms of governing the global economic order. The second radicalization is that sovereign equality also has material consequences, that it grounds a claim for redistribution of the world's wealth. And it does so on the basis, on the grounds that the post-colonial world has contributed to the world's wealth.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I mean, in both these cases, I mean, in the Balkans in the 1870s and in the West Indies and Africa in the 1960s, the desire for state power trumps all other alternative visions of how this new order might look like. And now this is a billion-dollar question, but why is this the case? Where is this fascination with the state form coming from? And how does it operate in your work?
I think this is a really hard question.
Yeah.
And, I think it, and I agree with you. It is the question. I don't think I have. I definitely don't give an answer to this question in the book. I'm hesitant to offer one now too. I guess I would say. I mean, it seems like, one set of pressures is coming from the closure of alternative possibilities. So in my case, for instance, that other models of imagining equality fall away during the interwar period. So yeah. Just to give two examples, the kinds of imaginations of the idea of imperial citizenship, a British empire that could mm-hmm. secure the rights of its subjects wherever they may be, begins to be undermined in the early part of the 20th century. It does so both in part because a racial imaginary of the British Empire means that migration and mobility gets restricted of Indian subjects, also West Indian subjects. So the sense that, you know, one version of solving the empire problem was just to create equality within the empire rapidly falls away. The others, I think, the same period generates other imperial imaginaries. You know, in part inspired by the example of Japan, but varieties of pan-Asianism, pan-Islamism. My new work is on Garveyism. So there's these other attempts to think about other imperial structures, a Black empire, Asian empire, as a counter power to, you know, to European empires. And I think this begins to fall away as the idea of empire increasingly becomes delegitimized. And it does so, I think, primarily on democratic grounds, right? On the sense in which these imperial structures are going to be necessarily hierarchical structures, right? And the kind of democratic egalitarian aspirations, I think, undermine the possibility that empire, counter empires could challenge this view. I think that's a final, you know, alternative that also begins to recede is one that imagines, world revolution in the wake of the Russian Revolution as the site and space through which imperialism might be overcome. And someone like George Padmore begins in the space. He's a, you know, active in the Communist International. He's thinking through in the 1920s and 30s how to think about the status and condition of colonial labor, right? And the ways in which the colonial labor fits into a kind of global conception of revolution. But that space also increasingly gets closed, I think, both after, you know, the kind of settling on a policy of socialism in one country, but also as there becomes a real anxiety or worry that people like Padmore are engaged, are too nationalist, right? They're, and this is in a period when he's writing a lot about Liberia and Ethiopia and other places, Haiti. So, and there's a sense that this is kind of a bourgeois nationalism. So he is kicked out slash resigns from the Communist Party. And this is a moment in which he begins to think in ways that lead to the Pan-African Congress of 1945. Mm-hmm. So I think in some ways, one way to tell the story of the rise of the state is as a story of the closure of these other alternatives. I think a second equally compelling story, and this is one told in an earlier book by Manu Goswami in Producing mm-hmm. India, is a sense that in this context of a deterritorialized empire, in which the colonies are subordinated, economically subordinated, the territorial conception of something like India becomes a way of reimagining economic relations, right? So it becomes the counterpart to an empire for which the space of India or the space of India becomes a way of kind of counteracting a deterritorialized economic integration of the colonies and an uneven integration of the colonies. So nationalist thinkers kind of produce India as an economic space.
Fascinating. This might explain why the 600 or so princely states fade away in the late 1940s in India, which might not have been that clear to contemporaries or forlorn in a way.
Yeah, there's some great work on the princely states. There's in this surprising journal, well, surprising that this set of things would be in this journal, but the journal Ab Imperio published a kind of special issue on post-colonial federation. And there's two essays, by one by Rama Montana and one on by Kavita Dutla, who both of which examine kind of the politics of the princely states and the different imaginations that, you know, were circulating around how to think about the princely states as an alternative space to this nationalist conception of India. But I think what that suggests, as with the kind of all this new work on federation, is that the nation state, it wasn't, it's not that it was, it took a long time. It was a process by which it actually became the dominant form, right? And that process was uneven. It was not realized, it was realized at in different time horizons, at different places. So in some ways we have to kind of distend our conception of when and how the nation state became the dominant form.
Well, I know what I'm reading next. Thank you. Wonderful. Ultimately, you contend that the task of building a world after empire remains incomplete. If the idea of self-determination failed, how can these democratic and egalitarian aspirations of anti-colonial worldmaking be rekindled in the here and now?
Yes, I mean, I think this is a crucial question. And I also have not great answers for this. I mean, I think my own approach in this book and just generally in my work is to look at historical examples or, you know, actual actors in the world and try to kind of reconstruct what I take them to be doing and saying and thinking. So it's hard to say in some sense in the contemporary moment, where to look for those actors, right? Like who should we be thinking through, et cetera. But it seems to me there's a few challenges and questions that this period leaves in the contemporary moment. So I think one is, you know, as I mentioned, there was this interest in thinking about the domestic and the international together, nation building and world making together. And I think on the one hand, you know, and the project failed on both sides, right? So, it was only partially realized on both sides. So I think one set of questions in the contemporary moment is that how to think about domestic democratization, right? And think through these kind of conditions of international inequality. So I think that's one way of saying some of our questions remain at the core the same ones, but there is this sense in which our answers to that question won't be the same ones, right? So I don't imagine that, that ours will take the form, say, of that kind of strong regional federation may not be the exact answer in the contemporary moment. And I think also the answer to these questions, the kind of domestic democratization and the external question of hierarchy, may pull in different directions, right? So I think the domestic questions, say, about how to democratize post-colonial states, how to think about the pluralism of these states, a question that someone like Nkrumah, for instance, diminished in his own time, right, really necessitate thinking about forms of decentralization, right? And there's a great review article by Mervais Fejdullah called Just the Historiography of Federalism that really looks at these kind of decentralized visions of decolonization that were in play in the same period I write about. And there, those are kind of accounts of federation that have a deep critique of the kind of the state as a coercive institution, and they imagine more localized, decentralized forms of rule. I think there's a lot of generative possibility in those for thinking about democratization, for thinking about popular participation, right? And for mitigating some of the conflicts around, say, ethnic and religious pluralism. At the same time, I think that the vis-a-vis the centralizers, or there's also this, how does that kind of decentralized structure, how would it mitigate against or have a response to these questions of, you know, foreign domination, neocolonialism, et cetera? I think that how to square those two, I'm not exactly sure, right? So I think that's one question that remains with us, but has to be asked differently in light of the failures and limits of the moment of decolonization. I think the second has to do with just, you know, the altered political economic context we find ourselves in. I mean, the new international economic order, the visions of development that underwrite this whole period are articulated in a context where ongoing economic growth is still imagined as a horizon of possibility, right? And I think we inhabit in a place both ecologically that growth is impossible, right? And also economically, it seems like to have hit a set of real roadblocks. So what it means to build more egalitarian worlds in a context in which we can't depend on economic growth, I think is a question that's very different for us than it is for them. So these are just places I think I would start in terms of how to think about these questions for the present.
Last but not least, where has world making after empire led you? What are you currently working on, Dr. Geraciu?
Great. So I'm, you know, moving slightly backwards in time and looking at Garveyism, the movement sort of named after Marcus Garvey, and it's a project that takes me from the late 19th century into, you know, right about where this book begins. And I'm interested in this movement because it's still, you know, the largest Black mass movement. It had, you know, members and chapters across the United States, but also throughout the Caribbean and on the African continent too. So it's a way for me to continue to think about my interests in Pan-Africanism and Black internationalism, but to turn back to a moment in which this question of the nation state had not yet been settled, right? So to think about what these forms of internationalism looked like at a moment in which the institutional form of decolonization was as yet undecided. I think this project is also for me an opportunity to think more about popular politics and practices. So the first book really focused on statesmen and elites. It focused on high institutional politics at the League, at the UN. And this will be, I think, a way of thinking more about mass movements.
Dr. Geraciu, it was an immense pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for joining New Books in History.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to talk to you.
My pleasure.